And joining me in the KRVS studio this afternoon is artist Doris Bitar. She is here on campus as a guest artist and speaker. She gave a talk today at noon and will give another one tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. And anyone who was on campus over the past few weeks saw these lovely flyers that Renata Doman put up around campus to illustrate your work, some of your work, and to advertise the talks. Really lovely. The talk that you gave today was entitled Inside Arabic Calligraphy from Aleph to Zaha. And tomorrow afternoon, you'll give a talk entitled Core Patterns. So welcome to our campus. And
thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You got here on a gorgeous day. Very lovely day to see Louisiana. And, you know, there's a really wonderful thing about being on a campus or around a campus is meeting the people not only who work here, but who come as speakers, as guests, and enhance and enrich what's offered here on campus. And Renata has been really wonderful about that, inviting artists that the students would not otherwise encounter. You have a really interesting background. You're currently living in Southern California, in Los Angeles.
San Diego.
See, we merge those together.
They're very different, believe me.
San Diego. But you have a rather interesting background. You come from Lebanese parents, actually born in Iraq, but then they immigrated to the United States.
Yes.
How old were you when you came, or were you born here?
I was born in Baghdad, mm-hmm. and then we went back to Lebanon shortly thereafter, and then we came from Beirut, and by the time we immigrated, landed in New York, I was six.
And have you gone back often to visit?
A long period went by, but when I was in my mid-30s, I went back with my husband and our son, and since 1996. We've been back many, many times. We even lived there in 2005 for 6 months. At that point, we had two children, and they went to school and learned Arabic. And living right in Beirut during, you know, unexpected but tumultuous times. It was when the prime minister was assassinated, and we all heard it. And the whole country kind of turned upside down the next few months.
And you were there.
We were there, for better or worse. It was a little scary. But we didn't want to leave.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, family there.
And, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. And mm-hmm. and we just wanted to have that experience, have the children have the experience of living somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just enjoying it ourselves.
Right, it's a beautiful country.
It's a beautiful country. I did a lot of research. I took 4,000 photos. And then when I got back, it was the basis of my work for years to come. I'm a painter, but I started doing these photo-based narratives that eventually involved painting and interdisciplinary work and other things. But
that, you know, I know a lot of people listen to us online, and it may be that they would like to go to your website as we're talking and perhaps look at some of the images. And your website is your name, DorisBitar.com.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you say you're a painter, but when you look on your website, it's your work is just so much more vast than just describing it as painting. You do installations, you write, you do photography and paintings. Just an amazing collection of methods and mediums that you use. So you may have started off as a painter, but what began shaping your artwork? What really gave a sense of identity to your artwork?
Well, painting was very appropriate for me because I was interested in East and West, and the language of painting, its heightened development is really a Western phenomenon. And I kind of wanted to use the language that had depicted the East or the Orient for so long. So And I love to paint. I mean, you know, come on. I just love
the basis.
Luscious paint and all of that. But it was really conceptually based in the idea of I was going to pose as a Western heroic painter. I was going to quote from paintings in the past that depicted Arabs and other people, women and, you know, various things and make corrections on those paintings or create or put Arabic calligraphy, a phrase from contemporary Arabic poetry upon those images and combine them. And, you know, it was very much rooted in this idea of using the language of the master, which was really in the 90s. And
well, and the way you say it, to quote, I mean, we think of quotes as simply quoting from words and,
right,
you know, literary passages.
So I wanted to quote from like French old masters, Delacroix, Matisse, Fragonard. Jerome was so much over the top. I had no feeling for him, so I avoided him. But other, you know, painters, especially Delacroix.
And again, not quoting their words, you're using brush styles or images, or what do you mean by quoting?
I would sort of interpret it sometimes. Other times I would imitate it as carefully as I possibly could, like Fragonard. I just really wanted to get the exact details. That piece is not on my website, but
maybe they can search for it.
Yeah.
And now you do your projects, as we were talking earlier, and you're talking about your artistic development. You really were concerned with just the medium and painting and art as you were going to school. But moving to California, meaning became very, very important to your work. How did you begin approaching what you were going to talk about? What you were, you've mentioned a few themes, but how did you come up with projects and ideas?
Well, I coming to California, I had a very Bauhaus, Yale University kind of education. I didn't go to Yale, but all my teachers did. And so there's this kind of Joseph Albers School of Yale kind of education, which really helped me analyze paintings in terms of space, how things were functioning in terms of color, you know, the formal aspects I know really, really well. They'd never get to the meaning part, though. And if someone tried to begin by talking about meaning, it was completely dismissed. So you felt a little trapped, like, well, you know, but there seemed to be meaning and when the professors talked about it. But it was usually something they couldn't quite, you know, describe.
Clearly full-face
yeah.
describe.
And so coming to California, I felt a lot of freedom to jump in, and the traditions in the California, the more liberal traditions were figurative, whereas on the East Coast, the figurative traditions were very conservative. So there's very real differences between the East and West Coast. And San Diego, UCSD, University of California, San Diego, is where I found teachers that were part of the pattern painting movement that went to New York, came out of New York, but really didn't. It came out of San Diego, actually. I always tell people New York's a receptacle for great things.
Everybody comes there. They think they have
they
to go there.
They go there, and then things may happen from everything being gathered, but it isn't necessarily where most things begin. You know, Black Mountain was in Virginia, not – or West Virginia. Anyway.
New York takes credit for
but
it.
But then it went – yeah, then Albers went to Yale, and then, you know, but – yeah, I mean, New York's great, but it's not where things necessarily begin.
So what did that come out of in California, the patterns?
I had been working with pattern, but in this very formalistic way, kind of imitating Matisse, I guess. But here I am, a Middle Eastern woman, Arab woman, imitating this kind of painter who exoticized that culture, but did it exquisitely well. And so I was a little bit lost, actually. And I was also an activist on the East Coast. I was a labor organizer for 4 years. So coming to California, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I should join the picket lines or
pick up a paintbrush.
Yeah, pick up a paintbrush. It took me a few years to sort that out. I wasn't particularly sophisticated about conceptual art or any of that sort of thing. So I learned a lot. I read Edward Said. And his essay that prefaces the book Orientalism greatly influenced me. And I thought, I'm going to do what he's doing in literature with visual arts. I'm going to go back and look at the old masters, just like he looked at Jane Eyre and that literature and kind of took it apart. I did it with Delacroix. I looked at British painters too, but I was very, very attracted to the French painters. And I thought that was appropriate since Lebanon was a French colony. French was – supposedly it was my first language. And you know, that I could do something there. I could look at the artwork and kind of in a sort of enjoy the lushness of painting, imitate them, do my own interpretation, but also analyze them, rework them, deconstruct them, correct them, and say something, mix it with Middle Eastern writing, pose as a heroic Western painter. Kind of.
But expose something else. Well, what kinds of patterns did you start finding, and how did you begin incorporating those into your work?
Well, I was always interested in pattern, but I would have to say ornament too. So when you look at Delacroix, there's a lot of ornamentation. There's a lot of gilded things. And so it was both those things, luscious fabric and how beautiful it could flow and have shiny spots. And that doesn't have a whole lot to do with pattern, but it's related. Mm-hmm. More recently, I call myself a pattern archivist. I mean, I just collect a lot. A good chunk of the 4,000 photographs I took in Lebanon were from Syria and Iran. We traveled a lot, and I collected patterns I saw on gates, on dusty roads, and then I would create templates for them, and I would start to layer them and use them not so much as fill, because that's when we think of pattern, we think it fills in a space, but try to see if I could blow it up very large. Maybe it could be a structure. It could be very important, and other things could fill the pattern. Mm-hmm. So kind of turn it around. But I started out quoting these lush fabrics and, you know, that were in paintings and moved towards patterns and what are the roots of patterns. So I'm very interested in viewing the view of pattern as somehow cultural DNA, that it could tell you something about that culture. And in particular, in terms of Middle Eastern culture or Islamic culture, for lack of a better word, we can trace a lot of sources of these patterns. They didn't necessarily come from there. The Arabs pulled from and the Persians pulled from China and tribal arts and Byzantium. And, you know, if you go and look in the floors of Ravenna or in Venice – in San Marcos floor, there is the basic units of patterns that the Islamic cultures built upon. Hmm. So the cult, you know, comes from all sources, as does the music, as does, you know, when you think of Middle Eastern music, it's like the African drumming, gypsy rhythm.
From a pattern anthropologist, archaeologist, yeah, searching out those origins.
Yeah.
I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest is artist Doris Bitar. She lives in San Diego now, but her parents are from Lebanon, and she is talking about her work and a talk that she gave, today for the students here at UL Lafayette, and a talk that she'll give tomorrow afternoon, which is open to the public if you can go at 2 o'clock tomorrow on Thursday. Well, in talking about patterns that you have been uncovering, they're very appropriate also to the talk you gave today, which is about Arabic calligraphy. And I think we're all vaguely familiar with Arabic calligraphy. We encounter it somewhere, maybe in a news report or something. But most of us don't really study it, don't really understand the different letters as letters. But the title of your talk was Inside Arabic Calligraphy from Aleph to Zaha, and I assume that's the first and the last letter,
yes,
of the alphabet. When did you start becoming very interested in the calligraphy?
I guess it would be 1983 when I went to Egypt and I noticed that in the City of the Dead, which is a very fancy cemetery in Cairo, I noticed that the tomb of Ibn Barkuk's wife, the inside dome, both domes were fascinating, but hers was particularly interesting in that around the edge of a very large floral pattern was almost like a Renaissance slash African. I mean, it was a beautiful pattern. But around the edge was all this Arabic writing. But it was the letters were situated in this spatial arena of an architectural space. And it looked like you could read the letters as though they were in a space, the way you would read a drawing of a landscape or of a room or a still life. And then you can see these depths inside Arabic. And then the characters looked very figurative to me. They looked like they had human proportions. And that was the beginning. And so, you know, Arabic, though it's a phonetic language, I think never let go of the world of pictures, mm-hmm, and depth and perspective and orientation, mm-hmm, and those kinds of things. And so I was really deeply interested. And it really, this was 1983, it was a long time ago. And in the 90s, when I started teaching, I started offering this to my students when we did gesture drawing. If I taught a drawing class, we did gesture. Well, that's a very calligraphic line. And I started showing them slides of this and then built upon that, found artists that did it, talked to actual current calligraphers, asked them examining the spatial dimension was something they thought of, because people were saying, no, there's no space here. That's not what the artist intended. And those calligraphers are dead. Ha ha, you can't prove this. So I said, okay, I'll talk to calligraphers now. And I did – that's one of the things I did in Beirut. So by the time – and I presented this paper first in Beirut. And then by the time now it's developed a little bit more. And, it's just another way of seeing the culture, which has been said to be non-figurative, which isn't true anyway. There's lots of explicit calligraphy and graven images. They're all over the place.
Wait, if you could just clarify that just briefly for some people, again, listening, who may have heard that as well, that you can't make a picture of something, you can't paint a picture of something actual.
I mean, there are some groups in Islam that said it comes from Judaism. You can't use graven images in places of worship. But there are so many exceptions, even in Judaism. There's the Europa, Dura Europa on the border between Syria and Iraq is a synagogue that is just loaded with imagery, about as blatant as you could get. And the mosque in Damascus, I used to think when it was a Byzantine church, that's where the very pictorial mosaics were put, by the Christians, and the Muslims didn't take them away. They tended not to destroy things. They tended to add to them. I was wrong. Apparently, the Muslims put the mosaics up of landscapes and cities and flowers and plants and trees and everything, animals, and they depicted everything. Mm-hmm. And pretty, not that stylistically either, pretty graphically. So, and that was a place of worship. So there were so many examples. And then I'd read that 300 years ago or so, elders in Islam got together and said, no one can really depict the life the way God can, so let's just not worry about this rule. They sort of acknowledged that people weren't really paying attention to it. So that's really a myth that the West holds, but also they hold in the Islamic world. Mm-hmm. It's just a myth.
Right. And as with everything, it takes people like you, artists and discoverers and archaeologists, to reveal to us all of the exceptions.
The truth. Yeah. There's so many exceptions. How can you call it a rule? Mm-hmm.
Well, did you become proficient at calligraphy, Arabic calligraphy yourself?
No. And I don't even know Arabic that well. I mean, I'm one of these people who's had to take it 3 times before I can go to Arabic 2. I'm ready now.
You're ready. Okay. Well, how did the students respond to your talk? What kinds of questions did they have?
They asked great questions. Mm-hmm. I think actually the questions I got were better than at any other talk I'd ever given. I mean, they were like, what are the differences between Chinese calligraphy and Arabic calligraphy? And, how can you interpret these spaces as this is a small room, that's a closet. When you look at Arabic calligraphy, this is a big, vast hall. How do you do that? And we talked about cultural orientation, that different people may interpret it differently depending upon how you read, quote unquote, any image.
Right.
And it is directed by your cultural background. Mm. I always look to the right when I look at any image. Right here, I'm looking to the right, not to the left.
And that's cultural.
That's cultural. And I've tested it out on my students. My Asian students always look up and go down,
I guess it's what we tell our children when they're very small.
I've had some Israeli students who look to the right also. And then if you're more European background, you're going to look to the left. You kind of follow visual images the way you were taught to read, or at least the way your parents pointed when they showed you a scene when you were a baby. And theirs is tied usually to language.
Hmm. Fascinating.
I think. I'm not an expert. These are just things I'm curious about, and then I'm always sort of testing them out. My students don't know it, but they're my guinea pigs.
Well, I mean, isn't that the most wonderful thing about artists, that you're curious and you make us curious and you make us look in ways that we might not have looked before? If you are just tuning in, you can find out more about Doris's work at dorisbitar.com. There are some images of the calligraphy and the way she uses that in her work, and also papers. If you're interested in the subject, your site has a wonderful collection of your writings. You write a lot and you give papers around the world. So if you'd like to know more about the calligraphy, you can find a wonderful paper on that at that site. Now, tomorrow you'll be speaking more about your core patterns at 2 o'clock tomorrow, and that will be in Griffin Hall in the auditorium, room 147. So I imagine you'll be showing slides along with that
yes,
talk?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I will give a little bit of the where I came from, but get to these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
quickly.
Talk about some of the projects. I mean, some of the projects you've done are absolutely fascinating, and they include more than just visual patterns. You incorporate other things in them, too, that have to do with sound, music, poetry, touch and smell. I love the one where you ordered all of these blocks of soap and created a pattern out of those. It must have been a lovely scent of soap in that room.
Yeah, that was in a way my first installation, maybe my second one, where I just kind of went a little crazy. I had a retrospective show in Ravenna in Italy at the Nina P. Gallery. And there was a back damp room that they never knew what to do with. And they could never really paint it because the paint would start peeling. You know, Ravenna's under sea level, below sea level, not under. They're below sea level. They're sinking.
So it's not just Venice that's.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And it was very damp, and there was something slightly unpleasant about it, but it was something magical about it. So I ordered. I loved the mosaics. And as I said before, the floor in San Marcos in Venice, or the mosaics in Ravenna, are the template for that Islamic art used to begin its new culture. So I wanted to sort of pay homage to it. So I ordered 1,100 bars of olive oil soap from Lebanon, white and green bars, and I created this giant braid on the floor, and Greco-Roman braid. So it was kind of like Ravenna was a very hermetic city. It didn't let anything in. It only let out. It let out all these patterns to the world. It didn't let anything in. There's one thing they let in, soap.
Soap. And so you brought it back in.
From Syria. So to remind them that the origins of soap are from the Middle East, mm-hmm. the Arab mm-hmm. world, the sophisticated bar of soap as mm-hmm. opposed to other oils and, mm-hmm. you know, it was when it was really a nice bar of soap, mm-hmm. Was imported into Ravenna. So I was like, okay, I'm going to bring it back and make and shape this large braid out of it. So a few years later, I won, and it was a collaboration with the Kura company, Siphon Brothers in just south of Tripoli in Lebanon, in Kura, Lebanon, where a lot of the great olive oil comes from. And then a few years later, I thought I wanted to do other collaborations with a poet and then with a musician, where I blew up the pattern so it looked like structure. It wasn't small anymore. And designed a musical instrument, 87 strings, that has another pattern that glides across it that has a mechanical finger that plucks it. And this musical instrument is really a giant harp, and it's in three sections. And each section is scaled to a different culture. And I was trying to have it relate to the cultures of California. So one section is Aztec, Chinese, and Indo-European, or Arabic, or harmonic, pentatonic, and a simpler pentatonic. And so people could literally hold this metal screen that had been powder-coated and glide it across, push and pull to get a softer or harder sound and create their own music. You can also pluck it. But it's more fun to glide this.
So there's a visual pattern, but also an oral pattern
yes.
that as you moved it, you could hear different
you
cultures.
Could hear it. And it sounds quite nice. And if you go to the website, you could click on that icon and a little viewer comes up and shows you. Turn on your sound.
Mm-hmm.
And behind the musical instrument were painted patterns similar to the gliding one. So you can also create patterns. So it's a kind of pattern and music making machine.
Wow, I can imagine a lot of people wanting one of those in your home. In their home.
I wish. I mean, yeah. then I could like quit my job.
That's right. Again, my guest is Doris Bitar. If you're interested in what she's talking about with her art, you can either go to her website, dorisbitar.com, and see the images and installations and hear the sounds, or you can attend the lecture tomorrow at 2 o'clock, Thursday afternoon in Griffin Hall, room 147, from 2 to 3:15. A lot of space in that auditorium, so all are invited to come and listen to the lecture as well. So what are some other installations that you've done? I know you also have done some that involve movement in addition to the actual, with people dancing and the singing.
Well, when I did this musical piece, I did a sort of a phrase-making piece where there's 450 words, and I worked with a poet. She chose the words, Diane Gage, and brilliant poet in San Diego, whom I trust enormously. And I chose some of the words because there were things she forgot.
They were personal to you.
And it worked out great because you were able to create phrases. You knew just exactly how many is and ands to
add.
Yeah, to have in the whole mix. And the piece encouraged, the words were carefully chosen to encourage people to think about their ancestry and where they come from and how cultures mix. Same thing as the instruments. How can one instrument have Aztec and Arabic music on it, or, you know, refer to gypsy music and Chinese Persian music?
How can
in
you
one
embrace
instrument?
And hold all those?
That's right. And what would it sound like, you know, with one instrument? There were other pattern-making pieces. And currently I'm collaborating with Noni Lazaga, a Spanish artist. And that I only have sketches of. It's not on my website. But her work is very minimalist and with threads. And it's the first true collaboration where I can, like, take her string pieces and plop them on top of my patterns. And she can take my patterns and mix them up with her string pieces. And, you know, we're looking at bar graphs from The Economist magazine. We're looking at barcodes, which are stripe studies, in my opinion. Why, you know, I look at stripes. I love stripes. Why discriminate against barcodes? And we're coming up with something new. It's like a project that is neither of our works, but I think, something else.
I think that strikes people when they hear artists such as yourself talk about your work. There's a fearlessness to it. It's like boundaryless, you know, artists without borders, that the collaborations that you do are amazing and I think make all of us see things in ways that past artistry didn't. There's just a... again, a fearlessness to how you move among patterns and sounds, and you don't stay with one medium. So many artists seem to be working that way.
You know, that didn't happen overnight, and I was very reluctant to move into installation because it had to feel right and be easy. So I don't know if fearlessness is necessarily, you
didn't
know,
feel that way to you over the years.
I mean, I'll tell you, the most scared I ever was when I was painting. Because it's such a chaotic material and can get out of control. And you really have to have a – when you're a painter, you have to almost be like a ceramicist, like it's no big deal. But it always seems there's this big specter of like the existential. I think painting is really scary. but you know, I don't think of it as fearlessness so much as it's just, you know – a progression I'm following. I don't know exactly where it's taking me. I find a person I can mesh with somehow. Nani and I just got it together on Skype and joked around for almost 3 years before we did this project. And then when I was in Paris for another show I'm in, I went to Madrid for 2 days and we were just in geek heaven, pulling and taking from each other and working in her studio and working in her house for 2 days nonstop.
So there's a great joy in it as well, just a play. You play.
As I mature, it's more and more about pleasure and curiosity and less about fear.
Well, we can see that in your images as well. And I hope people take the opportunity to check your website out and they can see these images. Or again, my guest Doris Bitar will be here at UL again tomorrow afternoon, 2 o'clock, Griffin Hall, room 147. That's the auditorium on the first floor, showing images of her work and talking about her work as well. Thank you so much for taking time today to come by and talk with us, Doris.
My pleasure. Lovely, lovely university town.